Today is full moon. You notice that big thing in the sky? And in Buddhist cultures, full moon days are days of celebration. Quite often the various great historical moments of the Buddha's life were celebrated on full moon days. Because if they would have, that's the way the communities could have gathered on full moons. They'd probably didn't have very good watches in those days, so they used the moon. So our tradition in Thailand celebrates this full moon day as Magga Puja. Magga Puja is celebrated in Thailand as the day when they say 2,500 enlightened men and women came together, monks and nuns, and lay people, to be with the Buddha. And it was also the time when the Sangha first, traditionally it said, the Sangha first began to see the need for some kind of organizational structure, some kind of rules and common agreements to live by. This is how it's celebrated in Thailand. So what it signifies for us is the Sangha Day. We call it Sangha Day in our Western monasteries. And Sangha means spiritual community. Now, I've had the good fortune to be in monasteries for quite a few years now. And I've lived in spiritual community. And the values of spiritual community are very important for the practice, because it's not an easy practice, I think, Buddhism. It's a do-it-yourself religion. And you really have to, you have to train, you have to be disciplined. It doesn't happen for free, like anything. You have to really work at it. And that work can be difficult. So the help of spiritual companions, of other beings who are doing the work, is invaluable to encourage us to instruct us, and also to give us a chance to share what we've learned. And so, say for me now, I've had this chance to share some of my insights with you, and this gives me a lot of joy. I'm one of those beings that enjoys what I do. Very fortunate, very blessed that way. And just contemplating this curious thing of being able to give, because being able to give and share is actually a very joyous thing, isn't it? So one always feels grateful to the person one's giving to. This is kind of curious reverse, isn't it? And so many people have helped me and offered me food and taken care of me while I'm here in Ottawa, and they keep thanking me. And I say, oh, but I want to thank you. So there's this kind of mutual joy in giving that you have. And I think this is one of the kind of foundations of Sangha, of spiritual community, where it's based on mutual support, mutual giving, rather than competition and other kinds of energies you might notice in society, which are not so wholesome or helpful. And I think that when I travel to different cities, like I was in Toronto this weekend, you can see this is a great hunger for spiritual community. This is something that people really long for. Companions, people that they can talk to about the practice and compare notes and encourage each other. So if you have that opportunity as friends to support each other in the spiritual life, it's very, very important. I think in the texts, Venerable Ananda says to the Buddha, or the Buddha asks him, what proportion of the spiritual life is good friendship? And the Venerable Ananda says half, and the Buddha says 100%. 100%. The spiritual life is 100% supportive fellow-minded beings. Without that, it's difficult. Both difficult that in the sense that one doesn't have any external perspectives, but also difficult that if you can't give and create and offer yourself to something, I think there's something really lacking in the human heart. If we can't, if we don't have the opportunities to give and share and create, then that flow of energy, I think, is very important, because it's part of the spiritual life is joy. One of the factors of enlightenment is joy. It's a factor, it's not the result. It's, you have to be joyous. Like, the Buddha wasn't depressed. He wasn't kind of a manic depressive or something that was doing his own work and trying to figure out his head in some way. He was happy being. Happy being. So, and part of that joy comes in this whole attitude in our spiritual life of sharing and giving. And so that's why dana and that kind of our sense of responsibility to what we are in society is so important in the spiritual life. We had I was thinking, like, there's kind of many ways that we can be happy. Maybe you could invite those people in. They look a bit shy. Just behind you there. Come on in. Please. Yeah, leave your doors open or whatever. Come on in. We can be happy by getting things. You know, so we get happy by getting a seat in the hall. Certain kind of happiness there, isn't there? You're in, you're not out. So there's the kind of happiness of acquisition, of having and owning and so on. But there's also the happiness of giving, isn't there? And that's very, very kind of profound happiness. We had a nun, Sister Nanda. She's died now, and she became a nun at 80. She was an English woman who, she's got a lovely story, actually. She was a nun for 10 years with us. And she met us about 5 years before she became a nun. So she had been in Sri Lanka with her husband, who was an Englishman. He was an engineer building bridges or something. And then met us, you know, when she was 75 and became a nun at 80 and died in the monastery at 90. Sort of a nice. She wore white, and we let her keep her hair. Because she was a bit frail and old. But there's this lovely story where she had this passion for making fudge for monks. And, you know, the monks had a passion for eating it. And she used to get so much joy out of it. In the monastery, we have these all-night meditations. And we usually start at about 7:30, and at 12 o'clock someone brings out some coffee or tea, and then we meditate through to the morning, and she'd always bring out these big trays of fudge that she had made. Well, we had His Holiness the Dalai Lama was giving a talk in Royal Albert Hall in London, and we were given 50 tickets to go see him. The day before we went, Sister Nanda asked Ajahn Sumedho, my teacher, "Can I make some fudge for His Holiness?" And he said, "Yeah, go for it. Do it." No idea how we were going to get it to him, but so she was so happy making this fudge for the Dalai Lama. And then the way it worked out was that we had rented a bus, and as we got off the bus, there were three blocks of tickets. And they were just sort of handed out. And there was one block, and the one block was up in the gallery overlooking the stage, and the other two blocks were lower down. And the stage in the Royal Albert Hall is a beautiful round hall. It seats about 5,000 people. The stage blends into some of the aisles. So if you're sitting in the seats, you can go right onto the stage. And sure enough, of those blocks, Sister Nanda and the other nuns had the block which was right next to the stage, and they were just handed out. There was no plot here, or maybe there is a plot. and I was up in the gallery, so I could see I could see Sister Nanda. She negotiated slowly, and she traded seats. So finally, she was in the aisle seat, right, and she. She had her little bag of fudge. She was ready. And then His Holiness gave a beautiful talk, as He does. And the whole audience then, at the end of the talk, was applauding him. And Sister Sundar, a French nun, then helped Sister Nanda up. You know, she's about 86 by then. And she couldn't see very well. I think she just went by instinct. But she was radiant, this radiant little lady. And so Sister Sundara kind of led her to the edge of the stage and gave her a gentle shove. And then Sister Nanda walked on the stage. And you can see, imagine this scene. There was 5,000 people. They're all applauding His Holiness. All of a sudden, this little white being, all in white, white hair and white robes, and gets this bag of fudge. And she came onto the stage, and then she got on the ground and bowed. And His Holiness picked her up, and she gave the fudge, and He blessed her. It was just so moving, you know. Everyone was in tears. It was very, very moving. And she went back. And so this was the high point of Sister Nanda's life. And it was just this radiant joy from this woman. And she was a great gift to the monastery. And what was interesting about her life was one of total service, where she had been in Sri Lanka with her husband, and he developed a very slow, debilitating nerve disorder. And so she had to nurse him, you know, for like 40 years or something, constantly. And another tragedy was her son had been in the Second World War and was shell-shocked from the war and never really recovered, and so she took care of him too. It's been her whole life taking care of these two beings, so it was a total life of service. The result for her was this radiant joy, this kind of radiant joy about her, and she was such a gift to the monastery and a very good reflection for all of us in the monastery. And I think that you know, that we have to be careful that the spiritual life doesn't become a self-obsession. It doesn't become something where, you know, I'm just so concerned about my own predicament that I become insensitive and selfish. And yet, I have to be concerned about my predicament. Because I think we've all seen also people who serve but don't do it with wisdom. And then maybe become bitter, or they have to serve, or they're forced into a situation of having to serve and having to relinquish or renounce, and they don't have joy. So service in itself, caring in itself, as just an activity without wisdom wouldn't necessarily work. And so the factor is that human ability to be able to reflect on the inner world in a life of service. And I think this is the ideal model for our attitudes to society. At least this is what I find inspiring. So we talk about, monks tend to talk a lot about the inner world, how to work on the inner world, and how to liberate the mind from its wrong views and wrong understandings and obsessions and difficulties and troubles. But it's always done in the context of an attitude in society, I think. An attitude of, like, what is my responsibility? What are other beings doing? What is my responsibility to them? Now, the last few talks, I was talking about the Four Noble Truths. And I tended to talk about the first three. And this is the paradigm model of practice, which I have been given a lot in my own, through my own teachers. And I'll just remind you that it's a medical paradigm, or one way to look at it, that there is disease, there is sickness, there is diagnosis, prognosis, and there's a cure. Or there is suffering or discontent. There is its cause. There's its end. Prognosis is good. And there's the medicine, there's the path. Or there is the world, another way it's put in the texts. There's the arising of the world, there's the ceasing of the world, and there's the path that leads to the ceasing of the world. That's not Armageddon. It's a different way, because the Buddha talked about the world as we experience it in terms of thoughts and feelings, our bodily sensations, perceptions, memory, things like that. So this is the world. Actually, so it's the world we experience through our senses, not some kind of external thing. Now, the thing about the Buddha's teaching is that, at least I find, it's a very practical teaching. And the path, the Fourth Noble Truth, is a kind of, it's sort of the recipe. It's like, it's suggestions of how you do the spiritual life. Because it's certainly, it's nice to hear about someone getting enlightened, right? Oh, nice, you're enlightened. Good on you. But how do I do it? How do we all do it? And this is important. So the Buddha was not pointing to himself. He was saying, this is the path. And the path begins with what we call right view or right understanding. And it's important to say, look at the difference between right understanding and attachment to dogma. Because what is more, you know, what has been some of the worst things done in human history is are in the names of religion, the kind of inquisitions one hears about and so on in past history. And this has always come from an attachment to a viewpoint. Attachment to a viewpoint. Now, right view or right understanding is an attachment to a viewpoint. It comes from insight. It comes from revelation. Now, when you, like, if I'm a Buddhist and something happens to someone and I say, oh, it's your karma, just sort of spit it out, that's the same as saying, someone falls down, it's God's will. What's the difference? It's just a way of saying something you don't really know. So you're just going to spew out this dogma. Right? We're just attached to a viewpoint. This is the way it is. But we don't really know that. We just know the person fell down. And then we lay on top of it our worldview of it. Might sound reasonable, might sound unreasonable, but whatever. So that kind of superficial opinion, say, just opinion about something, is not really liberating. It doesn't really free you. If, however, I see that if I speak to you in an unkind way, and then later on I feel afraid of you because of that, and I notice that connection, I say, with this kind of speech, this kind of karmic result, that's an understanding, isn't it? And if my viewpoint on life comes from that kind of understanding, it's not a dogma that I attach to, it's truth. As I realized it. Now this is the difference. So when we take a teaching and we just kind of read about it and say Buddhism says this, this and that, or Christianity says this, this and that, or Islam, and we don't really test it or verify it or say realize it for ourselves, then it's not a truth that liberates. It's just another opinion. Yeah? Opinions don't free you, do they? And when we attach to opinions, we become very obnoxious. What's more obnoxious than a really opinionated person? They can be very powerful, can't they? You get a really... Someone with a clever opinion can really make you feel intimidated. And they can be very oppressive. One sees that. So when we talk about right view, right understanding, it comes from seeing clearly the way things are. And there's something very liberating about that. And all of us have a certain amount of that. If you've got a stove... And the element is hot and it's red hot, you know that if you put your hand on that, your hand's going to get burnt. Now, if someone comes at you with the opinion, actually, you'll be all right. You'll be protected. If you just put your hand on that, you'll be right. You say, no way, that's wrong understanding. And you're not coming from a dogma, are you? You just know when you put your hand on that red hot thing, it's going to burn you. You have right understanding because you have the experience, you have the insight. Right? So the Buddha's path, it kind of begins and ends with right understanding. Because right understanding deepens and becomes more profound as one practices. Just like in our own lives, our understanding of the world becomes, just through experience, becomes somewhat more refined or more deepened, just because if we've reflected on life. if we've reflected on life. But in Buddhism, we're right under the first bit of right understanding is that I suffer. That doesn't sound like much. Yeah? But to actually take that on board and say there is discontent is the beginning of right understanding. Yeah? And because it's from that, that if we use that, we question, we begin to understand the cause and the end of suffering. Yeah? So that's the beginning. And the end of right understanding is seeing. Seeing that the cause of suffering is attachment in more and more and more profound ways. Now, from that kind of right understanding, then, is the whole kind of philosophical teaching that you find in Buddhism, the teaching on dependent origination and the three characteristics and all kinds of different teachings. And they're all really one package. They're all looking at right understanding in different ways, looking at it in different ways. And it can, if you look at Buddhist texts, it can seem very overwhelming. You get all these teachings and these different ideas, and you might feel very confused. The point of it all is to free us. The point of all is to free us from suffering, free us from attachment. And so the way we develop right understanding is by taking the teaching and using that as a theme, which is the way I like to say, as a theme for contemplation. And this is what we mean by, you know, like sometimes people think that Buddhism is like just meditation. But meditation is usually you're just sitting and calming the mind. But contemplation is very important. Contemplation is the ability to take a Dharma theme and keep working it over. Keep it alive in your mind. Keep the Dharma alive in your mind. That's why meetings like this are good. And reading books and talking about Dharma. And the basic theme that we're always trying to contemplate is that feeling of discontent that arises in the heart. Beginning to look at that in its various ways of fear or anger or whatever. Huh? So from that kind of right understanding, if we believe that, so you have to have faith in that, that suffering has a cause and it has an end. And the cause, that inner suffering we have, is our responsibility. So that's faith in Buddhism. If you have enough faith to look at your own stuff, to take responsibility for it and try to sort it out and understand it. If you don't have that kind of faith, then you can't get on the path. And if you don't have that kind of faith, you usually blame yourself for suffering, isn't looking at your suffering, blame someone else, or distract, some kind of strategy not to look at that. So then the path can never begin. It can never really begin. So that's the clue, we say. And from that, you begin to get right thought. Now, right thought is not political correctness. You know? And it's another idea, you know, like political correctness. Can, you know, what is that? Well, it can be very oppressive, can it? Yeah? It's like you have to have Buddha think. If I use, and this sometimes happens in monasticism, let's say a monk uses a Buddhist word in a kind of different way, in a kind of creative way, because he's trying to be somehow freshen people's minds around these words, which can seem very stodgy after a while when you use words for 2,500 years. You want to freshen it up a bit. So maybe a monk uses a word in a kind of different way originally, just to jab people, wake them up, shock them, from his own insight. And then someone comes along who's a Buddhist fundamentalist. And we have them too. No one's free of them. And the Buddhist fundamentalist says, you use that word wrong. You're wrong. Because the text says it's only that. It can only mean that. That's thought police, isn't it? You're the thought police. You're not thinking correctly. You're not politically, Buddhistically correct. Now, that's not what we mean by right thought either. You know, it's not having the party line down, right? It's not thinking wrongly either. It's right thought is like, why do I suffer? That's right thought. Wrong thought is, if life was different, I wouldn't suffer. Or, you know, if I was born in China, I wouldn't suffer. Or if I didn't have a bald head, I wouldn't suffer. Or if my nose was bigger, I wouldn't suffer. Or if I won the lotto, I wouldn't suffer. Or whatever. Or if I kept my job and wasn't made redundant, I wouldn't suffer. Right? Well, maybe at an external level, things like that might be true. But at the inner level, the right thought is, why do I suffer? Right? Why is there this discontent? What does this feel like? Yeah? Which isn't, you see, that looks like being politically correct, is it? It's like using thought, then, to look at life in a way which liberates. And this is how we try to use thought. We try to use thought by, in a way to direct our minds to look at life. And this is what the Buddhist teaching is trying to do. It's saying that there's certain things that if you pay attention to them, it'll make you really happy. You know, if you really pay attention to these things, if you observe them and look at them and understand them, that will be a great source of happiness and joy and insight. Hmm? But if you don't look correctly, then you'll continue to suffer. We'll continue to suffer if we look in the wrong place. And the teaching is based on that. It says, look here. Look here, young man. Look at life in this way. Huh? And it's this ability to use a teaching and to look at your life that makes the teaching alive. Without it, it's just another opinion. You know, and this is why people love to talk about rebirth. They love to have opinions about past lives and future lives. But when you really ask, you really know? And people are full of opinions. And they'll argue, too. There's the Theravada position, and there's the Tibetan position. The Theravada position is it's instant rebirth, moment of consciousness. And the Tibetan tradition is the Bardo, right? So we have these different schools that have grown up around death and so on. And so you get scholars maybe arguing. And maybe psychics can see these things. I can't. Well, what's the point of arguing about it? And this is a kind of sickness that human beings have of getting their power trips out of views and opinions, arguing and fighting over an opinion. And a lot of passion and blood come from all of that, right? But that doesn't liberate the heart. It's a plague. So attachment to views and opinions leads to, like, if I have an attachment to a viewpoint, then I'll always see the world through that viewpoint. If I'm attached to, say, like, a creator God who is kind of involved in everything, then I'll assume that everything happens, it's God's will. God's doing it all the time. If I have a karmic kind of idea, then I'll always come from that position. I'll always view world from that way. If I'm an atheist, if I'm agnostic, or if I'm a pantheist or a universalist or whatever, I will view the world in that way. I'll have that bias or prejudice in my mind. Yeah? If I'm in favor of separatism, Reform Party, then I'll have my viewpoint on that. Who's right? So we form viewpoints from biases and from prejudices, but those are just opinions, right? But from seeing the way things are, we begin to think rightly. Huh? So the first right thought in Buddhism is like, what's happening? Well, how is the inner world? How am I affected? Huh? That's a constant awakening. How are you now? How are you feeling now? What's going on in your inner world? Which isn't a judgment, which isn't running away. It's awakening to the inner world. Well, from that kind of observation, we begin to see that some of our discontent and some of our happiness is from the way we are acting and speaking and living. And this is, so from right thought, we also have right action, right speech, and right livelihood. Now right, again, not because it's absolute, but because it leads to nibbana. You always have to remember that. And people ask, like, a morality. So, well, morality is just relative. You know, it's just kind of the mores of society, right? It's kind of relativism or something. But in Buddhism, if I act in a way which is violent, there's violent consequences in my own mind and in society and the way people relate to me. And that is not the road to nibbana. Right? So it's not right in the sense of what society says, but it's right in the sense of what it does for my heart and my mind. So if society says that, if you kill the politicians, or you kill the non-politicians, or if you kill the capitalists, or if you kill the bourgeoisie, if you kill the poor people, or whoever, you know, that you'll be happy, and it's right, and it's correct, and you get a medal and all of that, you still going to have to pay the price of being violent, right? So the winners of any wars are always, you know, they're always, God's always on the winner's side, but the whole society suffers from burnt out men who have been in wars. So our sister Nanda's son, the British won the war, and he was shell-shocked for a lifetime. Karmic result. So right action comes from understanding what the consequences of wrong action are and right action. And so it's around intention. It's around intention. So killing is violent, and you get a violent result. Stealing and dishonesty gives a fearful result. A self-hatred result, and promiscuity leads to a confusing result, and wrong speech. So you have these areas, say, about right action. So it's not killing, not stealing, not getting drunk, you know, just the kind of basic moral values, living a good life, living a pure life. And that is more and more refined. So the Buddha's teaching is saying, well, look at your actions. How do you act? And refine that down. Not out of any kind of opinion, but because you have right understanding about action. And I see that this kind of action leads to this kind of result, and this kind of action leads to a different kind of result. If I put my hand in the fire, and I take it out, and it's all black, and that's interesting, and I put my hand in the fire again, and my finger falls off, and I look at it, and I say, I wonder why that is. And then I see, with fire, you get burnt meat, burnt hand, right action, wrong action. When I care for someone in the right way, in an appropriate way, there's a joyous result. Or there's a, I've had this opportunity to take care of my mother, and the results are really beautiful. I really feel good. And that doesn't mean that I enjoyed it all the time, did it? It's not that. It wasn't like having candy canes all the time, is it? It's different. It's a different kind of result. But you can... So there's right understanding about result, isn't there? And right thought from action. Right speech, then. Developing speech which is harmonious. Speech which is in concord. Speech which is truthful. Speech which is beautiful. Speech which is Dhamma. Speech which is sensitive. Lifetime's work, right speech. Something we can always work on and refine. From what? Not from feeling guilty about speaking wrongly, but from awareness. I see that when I speak from intentions, and it's about intention, which are sensitive and kind, I feel really happy and good and clear. And there's no remorse and no regret, and the mind has clarity. And that's a factor of enlightenment. Ethics in Buddhism are not just moral positions, but the ultimate ethical goal of Buddhism is liberation. So the point of Buddhist ethics is nibbana. Right? And it's, you know, so you begin to contemplate speech. So right thought, right speech. You know, well, how do I speak? Where do I come from when I speak? Where do I come from when I don't speak? And what's the effect on others, and what's the effect on me? Then right livelihood, which is very hard, difficult one. But in those days, I think it was much easier. You didn't have all these difficult ethical considerations. But then in those days, the Buddha said, not dealing in arms. So I don't know what kind of arms they had, really, compared to the stuff we get up with now. My gosh. But basically, not creating more means and systems of violence. Not dealing in humans, so that would have meant slavery and prostitution. Not dealing in poisons, usury. That was an interesting one. So they had a different usury. Was really exploiting people when they were down, you know, when they didn't have enough for their seed crop or whatever. They're really using that. Not dealing in animals. So there was this kind of responsibility to society that the Buddha recommended. Yeah? Not harming other beings, not putting harmful elements into society. Nowadays it's really hard, isn't it? I remember once we had a, in one of the monasteries I was involved with, there was a, and we were actually quite broke at it. And we had about $500 in the bank, you know, we're trying to build this monastery, $500. And one of the committee members was trying to figure out ethical banking, right? And so we had these long committee meetings, which drove me crazy, over $500 about ethical banking. And it was very good intention, but it almost, the committee members almost strangled each other over ethical banking. It was so complex and so difficult, right? And where are you going to put your money? And it went on and on and on. And that's just part of the complexity of right livelihood in modern society. You want to get a job in Toronto, and you're an engineer, and you're unemployed, and you got a big mortgage, and there's a job available, but it's for armaments in America. Very difficult ethical, you know, ethical consideration. So, you know, I don't want to lay any trip on you, whatever. So, those are choices, you know, we have to make, difficult choices. But as much as possible, we try to really take responsibility for society in Buddhism. You know, rather than thinking the other guys are going to do it, we have to do it. Always that sense of ethical responsibility as much as we can. But also in terms of livelihood, I think all of us consider, those who are really developing, you know, a path and contemplation and meditation, how can I not be overwhelmed by work? How can I not just be blown away by work situations? How can I develop more mindfulness in work situations? How can I make work situations maybe where I feel some kind of creativity or expression that's worthwhile, not just kind of being a money nexus and getting money and buying things? Well, these are difficult things. But obviously, if you're mindful, and you're trying to develop a life which is free from suffering, you're going to be taking a good look at right livelihood. Then, from these kinds of considerations, you begin to contemplate, like, well, what is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration? And those are the areas around doing the kind of inner work of developing the mind and training the mind. Right effort. Like, what is right effort in the spiritual life? Is it the same as doing a marathon? Huh? Is that, like, when you sit in meditation, is right effort the same as doing a triathlon? What do they do here? Ski, skate, and run, huh? Obviously in Ottawa. But, well, you know, what is, when you sit in meditation, is that the same kind of effort? Is it the same effort as baking a cake? Well, what is right effort in meditation? What is that? Well, right effort in the path, in the contemplative path, is the effort to sustain the wholesome and to sustain the wholesome things that have already arisen. So, like, if you're living an ethical life, keep living an ethical life. If you practice meditation, sustain meditation. If your speech is beautiful, sustain beautiful speech. So right effort is to a certain extent sustaining the good, the wholesome, the beautiful. And all of us know how difficult discipline is. You know, you can all kind of, you develop your meditation. And, like, retreats are good, aren't they? Do a 10-day retreat. Everyone's inspired. You know, you get a few people who want to take the robe. And I'm going to sit every day. And I'm going to go for it. And I'm going to do 2 hours of practice a day. And I'm maybe write speech and really be kind to my partner, and and then it sort of wears down. And the way I like to joke is, like, you come back after the retreat and you sit for an hour, and then 2 months later it's a half an hour, 4 months later it's 15 minutes, and then 6 months later you kind of wave to the Buddha and off to work. That's it for the discipline. So it's very hard to maintain good discipline. I know, because that's why I became a monk. Yeah, I really needed help. I really needed spiritual beings and discipline and all of that, you know, because I knew it's difficult to sustain spiritual practices. It's not easy. And you need a lot of right effort. It's a subtle kind of thing. You need to wake up in the morning and sit for half an hour, or in the evening. You know, it's not like doing the triathlon, is it? It's not like that. It's much more subtle. And then, you know, the mind has all its whisperings and rationalizations that I need to do the crocheting today, I don't need to meditate or whatever. But sustaining the spiritual life is important. Yeah? So right after sustaining that which is good and wholesome in all the areas of speech, action, and mind training, and then developing the wholesome states of mind which haven't arisen. So, like, if I'm a very distracted and kind of sensual person, then developing some restraint, some renunciation. If I'm a very angry person, bringing forth thoughts of kindness for myself in the beginning, just may I be well, may others be well, bringing up wholesome mind states. So there's around the wholesome, there's sustaining the wholesome and bringing forth the wholesome things which have not yet arisen. And then on the opposite, there's the unwholesome things that we have in our lives, the unwholesome tendencies that we've unfortunately developed and gotten caught into, the unwholesome mindsets, the unwholesome ways of thinking or speaking or acting, abandoning those, learning to abandon, learning to move away from those, and protecting the mind from unwholesome things arising again, from coming into consciousness again, so cultivating good friendships and moral lifestyles. Now that kind of effort, you know, it's not, again, it's not like, it's easier than getting a gold medal in the Olympics, isn't it? I don't know, maybe not. But it's subtle. It's a subtle kind of effort. Yeah? Now that effort isn't just blind willpower. You can see, you know, sometimes with blind willpower you can meditate, but maybe you can't say a nice thing to your partner when you're in a bad mood. More difficult sometimes. Huh? You can maybe meditate and get the mind calm, but then be just very, very vindictive or cruel or something like that. So it's that ability to be awake to the different aspects of mind, wholesome and unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome, abandoning the unwholesome. And this is a constant work we're involved in, constantly putting forth that kind of effort. Right mindfulness? I don't know what wrong mindfulness is. I think wrong mindfulness would be not understanding what mindfulness is. This is the big word in Buddhism. Mindfulness is the path to the deathless, sati, awareness. And I think my most helpful definition of that is awakening. Awakening to the way things are. Huh? Now, my misdefinition of that used to be controlling. And it wasn't so consciously that, but that's what I kind of felt, that, you know, if I just kind of control everything, especially the emotional world, that that's being aware. But then, you know, what happens with that, it'll happen to me at least, that I can control for a while, but then I get overwhelmed. And there's this kind of explosion of stuff. And, oh gosh, I've blown it again, I've gotten angry, or I've just, you know, I've eaten too much rice. So like, I'd kind of, you know, I'd feel this greed for food in the monastery, sort of kind of malnourished. I was in my first 2 years of monasticism, I had a green complexion. So Sudarshan Samena tells me. There were no mirrors, so I didn't know. But I had a lot of difficulty digesting the food. The food was very, very coarse. And I was used to refined foods. And so I kind of have stomach problems, all kinds of really hard first 2 years. A lot of mind problems too, but I'd be really, really greedy for the food. And, oh, control yourself, Viradhammo, now. You're just going to... And then I'd do it for a while, then I'd just blow it. And then I'd feel guilty. Well, that wasn't mindfulness. That was just malnutrition, greed, overeating, guilt, all kinds of complexities. Then, what's really mindfulness? Mindfulness is, this is what it feels like to be hungry. Oh, I see. And when you're hungry, you feel greedy. Oh, is that right? Oh. big surprise. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be. Oh, so there's nothing wrong with greed. Oh, I see. Oh, greed feels this way. That's what mindfulness is. Whereas the other, I have to be a good monk. And you know, they say, chew slowly. And I want to wolf it down. And Ajahn Chah says, you have, you know, you finish eating. And then you do enough food and you have 5 more bites. That was the kind of monastic model. You can eat mindfully, and then you got 5 more mouthfuls and you stop and you know you have five more mouthfuls, right? I couldn't do it. It was too difficult. Because I was just trying to be what I thought was mindful. But I wasn't looking at greed. I wasn't looking at that, right? And then you know, my teacher said, well, just awaken to the feeling of greed. What does it feel like? And then that was mindfulness. And then I could begin to understand greed. It was natural. I could understand what the hunger was, like malnutrition and what that was, and learn from it. Learn from all that until my body adjusted and got a bit more healthy there. So like anger or greed or fear, or all these negative things that we have as human beings, they're to be understood, right? And you can only be free from something if you understand it. And that comes back to right understanding. Now, the Buddhist dogmatic position would be maybe you should love everyone, right? So you get the kind of bodhisattva ideal that I dedicate my practice to the benefit of all sentient beings. I'll work hard, which is nice. You define mindfulness from some kind of dogma. And that's attachment to dogma. It's not mindfulness. Whereas right understanding is that anger has the nature to arise if it's conditioned into the mind, but it has the nature to cease. What are the causes for its arising, and what are the causes for its ceasing? So we awaken to anger. Then the same with fear, and the same with doubt, and the same with greed, and the same with lust, and all of those things. And also the joy has a cause for arising, and compassion has a and if those are nurtured, they have a chance to radiate in our lives. And they can cease, too. They can end. They're not permanent. So you begin to see that mindfulness is this. It's not a kind of categorical imperative that you be perfect, but it's that you awaken to the Dhamma, to the nature of the way things are. But when I realized, it was so nice. You know, I didn't have to be anything anymore. Oh, how nice. I don't have to be perfect. What a burden, isn't it? Always have to be perfect. That's a really heavy trip that spiritual traditions lay on us. And then why is there so much guilt in spiritual people? You'd think they'd be the happiest ones going because they're trying to be good. Because it comes from this sense of attachment to an ideal or a dogma or a position. But with action and speech, we try to act and speak in a wholesome way. So how do you balance that? Does that contradict? Is that a contradiction that if I say to you, you could be mindful of anger, and then I say to you, don't bite your partner's head off if you're angry? Is that a contradiction? No, I don't think so, because there is restraint. There is indulgence, there is repression, and there is restraint. I can feel totally ticked off, and most of the times now, no. Used to be, I mean, getting better at it. It used to be very difficult not to speak out of anger. Now, because the anger's worn down and I know the consequences of wrong speech, it's much, much easier, right? So there's a possibility of right action, right speech, and yet allowing one's karma to run its course. And this is the path of awareness, awakening to the way things are. So the right speech, right action, right livelihood protect us, protect society. But then awareness is this kind of fullness. Awareness is a full embracing of your whole predicament. All the pain and all the joy and all the ugly bits of your mind and all the beautiful bits of your mind as just part of consciousness. And that's why it's a very kind of opening and welcoming practice rather than a controlling and restricting practice in terms of the inner world, in terms of the heart. And then as we stop identifying with the negative things and attaching to them, they cannot last. They cease. They cease in the mind. And that's where you say cultivation of the wholesome, abandonment of the unwholesome. So when you have right thought, then if I feel a cruel impulse coming into my mind, right thought is what? Is it, if I have a cruel impulse, I think, I want to take the air out of your tire so you freeze tonight or something. They sort of scheme and plot. It's a kind of feeling comes up in my mind. Or I want to hurt you, or I want to punch you, or I want to torture you, or something like that. That feeling comes up into my mind. Wrong thought would be, I am an awful person. Wrong thought would also be, how can I get this? How can I do it? Right thought would be, this is a condition that has arisen. Be aware of it. Don't attach to it. Be patient. It will cease. And then that cruel feeling goes. It ceases in the mind. So right thought would be careful. Don't believe it. But wrong thought would be indulging it or repressing it. Right thought would also be, yeah, maybe that's true, but I'm not going to do it. Huh? Maybe that's a feeling, but I'm not going to do it. So you can feel anything and still be aware of it and not attach to it. And that's how you get beyond repression in the religious life. And so much of religious life can be very, very repressive. And this is the, you know, if you get a group of very indulgent people, they wouldn't even speak about this. They just kind of follow their anger and follow their greed and so on. But the religious life has a tremendous tendency towards repression because of our feeling that when we notice something which is negative, that's who we are. But we're not. If I feel something negative, that's not who I am. It's just something that comes and goes, isn't it? It just arises and ceases. So awareness, right thought. So if I find my mind thinking cruel thoughts, now that's wrong thought. But I'm not aware then. I'm just lost by the cruelty. I'm just indulging in it. Then I can awaken. Now that's wrong thinking. That's going to just take me down to more cruelty. And I don't have to think that way. I can stop thinking that way. I can stop thinking and notice anger in my heart. You know, you can feel emotions bodily. You don't have to think them. You can feel fear. And it's when we got to notice a lot of our emotional world pre-verbally, before we proliferate and create around them, that they're not a problem. They're no longer a problem in our lives. And when there are wholesome impulses, you know, when one has a wholesome impulse, and one can cultivate right thought around that. You have a wholesome impulse, how would you like to help someone? You cultivate that. I was thinking, like, when you know, if you have a memory, let's say you spoke to someone 2 weeks ago and you said something really cruel to them, someone you love, and then, yeah, you didn't realize it that day or whatever, and you get that awful pain. You know, that awful pain of having hurt someone. Well, what do you do with that? Because what you've got is memory, don't you? You're stuck with that memory. And that's, first of all, that's a karmic result of being heedless. But let's say I say something unkind in a moment of heedlessness to someone, and then it comes up maybe a week later. Every day for a week later, or a month later. That's a very unpleasant feeling, isn't it? Now, that unpleasant feeling, if you have conscience, if you have a sense of conscience, can actually plug you into compassion. Or it can plug you into guilt. If I say something to you a week ago, and then I realize, I really hurt you. When I realize that I really hurt you, that's compassion. That's sensitivity. Now, that can then, so when I remember that hurtful speech, rather than feeling guilty about it, and thinking wrongly, I'm a terrible person, I shouldn't have done that, I should never be like that, I can think, I can get back to that compassion. That hurts. That hurts people. I'll try not to hurt people. So actually, like, if you're mindful and you're aware, even the bad things, if you have conscience, can be a source of compassion. You know, when I think of things that I've done that hurt people, when I remember that, If I don't get caught up into guilt, that actually helps me to be more compassionate, more careful to other beings around those kinds of issues. And awareness is this kind of, it really really understand life in that way. Rather than just react through guilt and repression and indulgence, just this kind of reactive mode of humanity. So awareness is the awakening, it's the seeing, it's the wisdom of the whole practice. Then right concentration, which is the last samasamati, as the last factor, is that ability to sustain your attention for a span in a balanced way. Your ability, like if you're watching the breath, concentration is the ability to notice one out-breath. That's it. That's concentration. You've noticed one out-breath or one in-breath. Just that ability to sustain. And obviously, in ordinary life, we need the ability to sustain our attention in all kinds of activities. So the ability to sustain your attention in the way you relate to people, in the way you speak, in the way you act. Samasamadhi. It's balanced emotion. Like when you can't sustain your attention, what happens? You get blown away. You get angry, you get fearful, and so on. So samasamadhi is this ability to be present for a span. So you have awakening, you awaken to the way things are, and then you sustain that awakeness for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, hopefully for longer. And from that you get more and more right understanding. So they feed each other. With right mindfulness, you get right concentration, if you're looking at the world, you get more understanding. If you get more understanding, you think more clearly. If you think more clearly, your actions and speech are right. So these things balance each other. So there's a lot of concepts there, but if you take that and take those themes, like what is right speech? What is right thought? What is right understanding? What are those things in my life? That awakens the mind to the path. Then one's intellect is geared towards enlightenment. One's thoughts, one's conceptual frameworks are geared towards enlightenment. All right. That's quite a lot to consider. I'll leave that for tonight. Thank you for your attention. Does anyone have any comments or questions before we have this famous cup of tea? Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
What is your view about the future of Buddhism in Canada? Have you any thoughts on it? And what is going to be the best way to spread the Buddha's teaching?
Oh, the best way is practice yourself, by far. You be free. And Ajahn Chah used to say, you know, we asked him when we went to London, what are we going to do in London? Because none of us actually are into proselytizing. None of us have ordained, you know, to spread Buddhism. That's a kind of foreign idea to me, actually, to spread Buddhism. But what Ajahn Chah said, he make a good soup and people will come. So, but what Buddhism might become is very interesting, you know, because you get some very interesting, creative, different ways of practicing. You get a lot of lay teachers now. You get a, you know, different therapies and body work, and it's quite a and it's the first time in the world where all the different great traditions are together: Tibetans and Zen and Theravada and, you know, different traditions. So it's a where it'll go, I don't know. You know, whether the monks have any place. You know, I might be sort of a evolutionary cul-de-sac. I don't know. So I just look at myself as a guinea pig in the West. And I mean, I like this life, but maybe monasticism won't be relevant. Maybe it will. That I don't know. But I know the way it'll really be strong is if people have integrity and they practice. I think you have to have the basics. If you like people who think you can practice Buddhism and be immoral, you know, I think they're screwy. They're just really off. So those kinds of flaky ideas, I can't agree with myself. So I think the basics of like morality and that, those are important. But say cultural Buddhism won't last. You know, just sort of superstitious cultural Buddhism, that won't have a place. But ritual, I hope that lasts. So the challenge, say, for Asian Buddhists is, how do you find your rituals for your young people? Because your young people aren't in a Buddhist culture. So how do you find this? How do you define that for a young Laotian, a young Cambodian, a young Vietnamese and Burmese to make it relevant? The only way you can do that is by understanding symbology. You know, so I think this is the challenge to the older generation, is to make Buddhism alive and hopefully also make the rituals alive. Because I think rituals, symbols, rites of passage, these are the richness of your culture, right? But you have to bring them, you know, when you come here, you have to define them in a way which is relevant, which is difficult for you because in your culture you just kind of did them, right? But like what I find in Western Buddhism, quite often people don't have rites of passage like birth, marriage, death. These can be beautiful times for Dharma contemplation. And so we've tried to cultivate those old ways of doing that. But the best way is really, you know, you cook a good soup. This is definitely the best way. But it's a very interesting time to be a Buddhist, I think. It's very, very stimulating and rewarding. Yes, sir. Vim.
Can you say that conscious breathing is one of the good ways to maintain sati in our daily busy life?
Yes, yeah. The breath is a brilliant way to come back to something very ordinary. You can't make a problem out of the breath. Well, if you have asthma, I suppose you can. But yes, it's portable, and it shows you where your emotions are at. It's inexpensive. But you need what a touchstone is. Touchstone is something that you touch to remember. You need touchstones in the religious life, and the breath is that. You know, that you'll find, like, even my father, you know, he never meditated, and he was, when was it? It was about 3 weeks before he died, I taught him Anapanasati. Right? And I didn't teach it as Buddhism or anything, he was just getting really anxious about his pain. So I just said, well, just focus on the breath. He could really relax. But the problem was that he hadn't developed it for a lifetime. So as soon as I went out of the room, he got tense again. Forgot to breathe. So that's why it's important to really have some kind of touchstone for a lifetime to turn to. Okay, shall we have a cup of tea or whatever? So thank you for your support and help and listening to my long talks. And I wish you all freedom from suffering and a happy year. Thank you.